Brazil is one of the world's largest economies by GDP and is abundant with natural resources. It also happens to be one of the parts of the world with some of the most interesting innovations in financial technology. Welcome back to Crypto Clarified. I'm Benjamin Dean. I'm director of WisdomTree's Digital Assets team. Today, we're going to be talking with Aaron Stanley, who's the founder of the Brazil Crypto Report. Before we get into that, US listeners, check out wisdomtreeprime.com on the Apple, Android app stores. Hit subscribe and share the podcast, Spotify, YouTube, or iTunes. You can always find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. Before we can start anything, though, James, Sam, in compliance, is everyone's favorite part of the show, the disclaimer. Before I begin, I need to state the following to clarify: the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree, Aaron Stanley, and the Brazil Crypto Report. They're also subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. All right, let's get on to the fun stuff. Let's transition to Aaron and see what he has to say about Brazil. Welcome, Aaron Stanley. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ben, for having me. Great to be here.
You have been very interesting and helpful in my ventures throughout Latin America, especially in Brazil. So thank you very much for joining me today for this episode. For us to kick things off the episode, we usually ask guests about their background, about why they're interested in this space and what they're doing at the moment.
Yeah, so my background is really primarily as a journalist in media in different capacities. I started working kind of in mainstream media to kick off my career in Washington, D.C., doing more kind of political coverage. Kind of got a bit bored of that, and then ended up kind of stumbling into Bitcoin in like 2013. I had a friend of mine who was a lobbyist who worked at the short-lived Bitcoin Foundation, if anybody remembers that. It had like a six-month run there before. You can Google it. It didn't really end very well, but it had a little heyday there for about 6 months. So she was like, "Hey, you should write an article about Bitcoin." I was like, "Oh, that sounds interesting." So that's kind of how I got into crypto. And then from there, kind of stopped paying attention to things for a little while during the block size wars and all that, when it was a little more like inside baseball. Started paying attention again in about 2016 when I was actually working at Financial Times back then, doing some freelance work for them. And they asked me if I could write a story about the Winklevoss twins Bitcoin ETF proposal. So I was like, "Oh, well, that sounds interesting." So I did that. The story got picked up by a lot of people. I got a lot of hate mail and stuff from it because apparently Winklevoss twins are very controversial figures. At least back then they were. That was like the kickoff of the ICO boom as well. So I ended up getting approached by CoinDesk, which was just kind of kicking off as like a trade publication back then. They're like, "Hey, we like your article. Like, you want to do some stuff for us?" So I started, covering, doing some stuff on ICOs. And my editor was like, he's like, "Hey, can you write about this ICO?" And I'm like, "What the heck is an ICO?" And then now it's kind of like, "Oh yeah, like ICO is sort of, that was back in 2017. So I ended up for a few years at CoinDesk as a reporter editor, ended up running we have this big event called Consensus that I used to run the programming for. So that was my job for a few years, was just putting together the content for all that. I'm actually, so I have this kind of still skill stack of like, I've been in crypto for a long time. I've been in media for a long time. I'm also married to a Brazilian. So I'm actually living in Brazil now. So I have this kind of skill stack of like, I know about crypto, I know about media, and I know about Brazil. Right. So I was like, maybe I can stack all these things together and maybe there's an interesting kind of project here that I can build out. And the genesis of it was really that we were actually living here during COVID in 2021, during the big crypto boom, like spring 21, if you guys remember that. And I realized that, for just a huge market here, there's really like no English language information on like anything that was going on here. So I was even like researching like, who should I meet here? And I couldn't really find anything. So if you don't speak local language, like it's really hard to find, or if you don't know like the right people, you really can't find any information about anything. So I was like, maybe there's a little niche here for a micro platform that's just focusing on covering, maybe Brazil and Latin America. That's a bit more tailored toward like professional stakeholders and trying to kind of explain things more for gringos and that type of thing. So I kicked this off sort of as a side project, you know, like 2.5 years ago. And, you know, it's interesting. It's like one of these things where like the market will sort of like just tell you if you have like a product that people want or not, you know, is sort of, and people like keep reading it and people find value in it. So I was like, huh, well, I guess, you know, I mean, it's not like a huge, like addressable audience, I guess, but like the people that do read it are pretty dedicated and they really get a lot of value out of it. So I've just been kind of doing this consistently for a couple of years. I've been rolling out more multimedia contents, doing more like kind of podcast interviews and this type of thing, doing a bit of like Portuguese language content as well. I speak sort of gringo Portuguese, I guess, but I can do, you know, I can hold my own in a conversation about crypto with people. So I'm doing a bit of that, but really the mission of the platform is really just to try to be a bridge essentially between, you know, North America, like just Western crypto, quote unquote, like the English speaking crypto world and what's happening in Brazil and Latin America. I'm primarily focusing on Brazil, but I've got actually a person who's helping me cover like the rest of Latin America. She lives in Bogota and she speaks Spanish pretty well. And she used to cover crypto for one of the big trade pubs. So she's been helping me. She puts out maybe a newsletter or two, like a month, just on what's happening in the rest of the region. You know, the other Spanish speaking, I'm more of a Brazilianist, not really a, you know, I'm kind of like the inverse of most people are like, they know Spanish and they know the rest of the countries, but they don't know about Brazil. I'm kind of the opposite. I know about Brazil, but I don't really know much about the other countries. So, but the two of us together, we kind of cover the whole continent, I guess. So anyway, so that's sort of what we're doing in a nutshell with the Brazil Crypto Report. It's just been kind of this fun, really audience is really mainly intended at like professional stakeholders. So I don't really talk about price or like what meme coins you should be getting into or what airdrops you should be farming, but it's really more about like kind of aimed at professional stakeholders who are, you know, either like allocating capital or making business decisions or I get a lot of interest from companies like gringo companies that are trying to expand into Brazil. That just want to kind of get, you know, a lay of the land or whatever. So, but yeah, that's kind of what we're doing in a nutshell.
Okay. Like, let's talk about Brazil then, to start with, because Brazil is a very interesting kind of financial market. Large population, lots of natural resources. It is technically Western in the sense that it's in the west of Europe, the point of reference. It's also Eastern, if you live in the People's Republic of China. Tell us a bit about what is going on with financial technology in Brazil. And part of that is Pix, part of that is USDT, part of that is Bitcoin. Just give the folks an idea of, like, in your, from where you sit, what's going on there with financial technology?
Yeah, so there's the last 10 years or so, there's really been a big kind of revolution with financial technology in Brazil, and it's all, a lot of this has really been led by the central bank, to their credit.
Yep.
They've taken a financial system that was very much sort of an oligopoly, kind of controlled by a few kind of monolithic, inefficient banks, essentially, and really kind of forced these guys to compete more. And they've really allowed for a lot more just kind of fintech innovation. Like Pix is kind of the crown jewel, right? So Pix is basically an instant transfer, you know, a peer-to-peer payment transfer system that is processing. I mean, this thing just launched maybe like, I think it was end of 2020 when it launched, and it's processing. I mean, the numbers are just like mind blowing. I saw a number the other day. I'm like, that can't possibly be real. It was like 300 billion payments that they processed last year or something. I was like, yeah. I don't even know if that's like real, but like, I wouldn't doubt it. But it's like massive amounts of transactions that these guys are doing, like just on a daily basis. And what's interesting is that it actually, you can see kind of like the fingerprints of blockchain, like within the Pix structure. So they're using like public key cryptography and kind of, and you could, I mean, it's like, it's very like, you can tell that the people who designed this have spent a lot of time, like kind of studying like blockchain systems, right? Like the fingerprints are there. So Pix has been a very revolutionary product, just in the sense that it's basically created a public system or a payment system as a public utility, right? Because people will be like, yeah, well, how is Pix any different from PayPal or Venmo or something? It's like, well, it's, you know, in function, it's like, okay, it's kind of the same. You just send money to somebody else's app, right? But in reality, like what's happening on the back end is that this is all being settled by like this. This is like a ledger controlled by the central bank where everything's kind of being debited and credited. Like the settlement's happening instantaneously. It's not like there's this 3-day float or whatever. And this isn't something that is like an option. Like all the banks have to offer this, right? So this isn't just something where, you know, like, oh, I may as a merchant, like I may accept your PayPal payment, I may not, right? So like all the people have, all these vendors have to actually like offer these services, or the banks have to offer it. Like vendors don't necessarily have to take picks if they want to, but like 99% of them will. Like you can buy a coconut from a guy on the side of the road with picks for like 2 AIs, right? And he'll have a little picks code you can just scan, pay him right there. So he doesn't even need to have internet on his phone. Like he can just, like I had a guy once who had, I was literally buying a coconut from a guy, and I don't think he had enough money to actually like pay his cell phone bill, right? Like he was, you know, he was just a guy on the road, like just selling this. So he didn't actually have, he had a cell phone, but he didn't have service on it, right? And he was asking me if he could connect to my hotspot so he could get internet for a few minutes. But I was still able to like pay him with Pix, even though he didn't even have connection to his phone, like to his, so not to go into Pix too much there, but it's just been a really revolutionary, payment system that they've developed here. And it's, you're seeing this being, copied by a lot of other central banks around the world. And then this is just part of one of the central bank's kind of broader innovation agenda around financial services. So they've got, like kind of a big like open banking, open finance initiative that's a bit more around like kind of data sharing and kind of breaking down some of the silos that have kind of permeated the existing financial system for a long time. And then the pinnacle of this is the Drex project, right? Which is basically, it's a CBDC, but the easiest way to describe Drex is it's kind of hard to explain because it's like you ask 10 different people, you get 10 different answers of like what this actually is. But the easiest way to think about it is like, it's like a hybrid CBDC smart contract platform, right? So in Brazil, like they've solved the payments problem with Pix. So they don't actually just need, they don't need like a retail CBDC just for people to pay each other with, right? So they've solved that problem. So what they're focusing on now is building out Drex, which will basically be like a wholesale CBDC that will function, you know, within, regulated financial entities within the financial system, the banking sector. But then also building out a EVM compatible, like Hyperledger Bazoo based tokenization smart contract platform. That will basically bring programmability to the smart contract tokenization operability to the financial system. So we can dive a little bit more into that, but that's kind of, in my view, it's probably like the most interesting CBDC project in the world right now, just because they're thinking about this. I mean, they're not just thinking about, you know, you have different kind of models of CBDCs, right? You have kind of like the surveillance state CBDC, you have kind of just like a general wholesale CBDC that just creates more efficiencies with kind of settling between banks and things like that. But these guys are thinking about is like, how do you build an actual financial system that is like built on, like how do you build like a smart contract platform that houses the entire financial system basically? And what can you even do with that once you have infrastructure? So that's really interesting. And it's definitely a thought experiment, right? But it's a super compelling, especially for a country this large, right? Like I could, you know, if, I mean, this is a G20 country, it's like the world's, you know, eighth or ninth largest economy. You know, if it was correct, like the Bahamas or something doing this, you know, it'd be like, okay, fine. But this is like a major world economy doing this. So that makes it kind of more inherently interesting, I think.
Now, I was told when I was in Brazil the other month that the reason this is happening is because the head of the central bank understands this technology. And they've basically mandated it, where all the banks have to get on board by the end of next year, or else you're not on board, you're off board. Is that true? I mean, is that a correct way to characterize what's happened there? Because like that kind of top down, you need the knowledge at the top, then you need someone who's in a position in which to exercise authority, really. And then that kind of all just filters down throughout what, as you've rightly pointed out, is a very big system. And is that a fair characterization?
I think so. Roberto Campos Neto is the president. Anybody who talks to him, anybody from the industry who talks to him, will give you the same feedback. Like, wow, this guy, he actually understands like what this technology is and what the implications are. He's really put a lot of thought into this. He really gets it. And to a certain extent, you know, he's been driving a lot of the financial innovation initiatives from the bank over the past few years. But he also has been, he wants to build kind of like a legacy for himself as well. Right. I think the way I think of these, I mean, maybe this is just my way of thinking it, but like all these, you know, political bureaucrat type people, they all kind of want to build their own pyramids of some sort, right. That they're like remembered for, you know? So like Gary Gensler will be remembered for, you know, the guy that like just threw it, he left it all in the field trying to like kill Bitcoin ETFs, you know?
Anything about that, Aaron. I wouldn't know anything about that. James is salmon compliance. I know nothing about that.
But with Campos Neto, I think this is kind of like his like legacy project, maybe you could say. So his term expires at the end of 2024. So that's one of the reasons that there's this big push to get this thing kind of up and running by. So they're in pilot mode right now. So there's 16 different consortia right now that are running nodes on the Drex pilot, on the Drex testnet. And these consortia are comprised of most, if not all, of like the major banks, financial institutions in Brazil, right? So there's, you have like you're like Nubank and some of your more upstart fintechs. You have some of your old guard banks like Itaú, Bradesco, BTG, exactly. Patual, these guys. A lot of the big like MasterCard, Visa, your big like kind of credit card players, your other payments guys, other financial infrastructure companies are all involved here. So even if this thing doesn't work, which, you know, I mean, it appears like it will in some capacity, but like we don't really know, you know, it's still a pilot, right? So we don't really know exactly what's going to happen. But even if it doesn't work, like just the fact that they got all of these guys onboarded onto basically, you know, a permissioned network that is operated by the central bank. Because I feel like that's been the problem with a lot of these permissioned blockchain projects in the past, is like,
which are databases.
Which are kind of databases, but like they're permissioned. But then the issue is like, well, who owns like the IP of this? Like, who's like the owner of this thing, right? So it's like, if I'm like a shipping company A, and I'm like, I own this thing, I'm like, hey, all my competitors, you guys should come onto my platform and we can all like share data. Or like, you know, and it's like, well, you know, the incentives aren't really like aligned very well for that type of thing to work. I think that's why a lot of these things never really like panned out as well as they were hyped. But if you have the actual central bank of the country operating this permissioned network, and permission, and I mean, the people that can operate, run nodes on the network are basically like people that are already kind of in the, they're already, they're already like licensed and regulated by the central bank, right? It's not just like anybody could just spin up a node, but these are the people that are currently involved. So I think there's an interesting kind of, it'll be an interesting experiment. It's like, is the central bank the right actor to be running this type of network? And can you get some of the efficient, does this solve some of the problems that we've faced in permission networks before? Are people trying to build these things on, basically like, you know, consortium, like blockchain based consortiums in the past?
Hyperledger. So,
so they are using Hyperledger Bazoo. It is Ethereum virtual machine compatible. So the idea is that you could take, you know, you can take like an Aave smart contract, you know, or a Uniswap or a Maker or like any of these kind of, you know, EVM compatible like smart contract protocols, and you could run these things inside this permissioned environment. So you're going to need to have bridges, and you're going to have liquidity pools, and you're going to have all these types of things. So the idea is that, like, you know, you're taking, you know, all these kind of like DeFi primitives that have been basically being like tested out in the wild in like permissionless land for the last few years. You know, can you take these concepts and, you know, redeploy them in a permissioned area? And it sounds sort of like heretical to like crypto, you know, diehards, I guess, that you would do something like that. But at the end of the day, like, people are going to go where the liquidity is, right? So if you can build a permission network like this, And there's liquidity there. These guys are going to want to go run their contracts in this permission environment, because that's where liquidity is. And how are they going to get liquidity? It's like, well, they can offer more, you know, for like regulated financial institutions and funds and things, we'll probably be more comfortable, you know, deploying capital into an area, into an environment that is being, you know, kind of controlled or monitored by the central bank more so than just kind of out in the wild. So anyway, so it'll be interesting to see how this stuff pans out. I mean, I think we're still early days, but it'll be interesting to see how this pans out. This is probably the most interesting like CBDC project in the world right now from my vantage point, like I was saying.
It's just like aviation or oil. It starts with hobbyists. You got wildcatting. You've got Wright brothers who are bicycle people who build the first flying vehicle. And then within 20 or 30 years, you've got bombs being dropped over Berlin, right? unfortunately. But it's not unprecedented. Well, I'm using double negative. It is precedented, and it's pretty obvious if you know about how technology plays out over history. There's an element that I want to ask you about, and that's about essentially like the competition that's occurring. I read that USDT Tether is extremely popular in Brazil, and that's even with PIX in place before Drax is put into place. What is going on with US dollar stablecoin, USDT? I imagine it runs on the Binance network, but you could correct me. What is going on there? Because that's essentially competing with whatever the Brazilian government wishes to do.
So the two main use, I mean, it's a great question. It's something I've been asking around a lot, actually, because there's like the numbers have been pretty massive. It's something the government was reporting numbers on these up until about August. And then they kind of shut down their system. They're like rebuilding their portal for reporting this information somehow. So we haven't gotten information since like August or September, but
of course,
basically it was about like $3 billion worth of USDT volume per month was what we were trending at like last summer, like at last, like August, July. And that was more than 80% of the entire volume of the market. So it was a pretty massive volume, right? The one nice thing is that like the Receita Federal, the Brazilian tax authority, that they report all this, or they were reporting all this information, with a level of detail that was actually quite illuminating. So they would break down kind of like the average transaction size per month and like all these types of things. So you could,
oh, wow.
So what was interesting was that the average transaction size for something like USDC was, you know, it was something in, you know, a couple hundred dollars or you know, fairly smaller transactions. Whereas with USDT, it was much larger. It was like, you know, like $15,000, you know, $20,000 transactions.
And the distribution is not normal, right? That's the average on a skew distribution.
Yeah, exactly. So like what that shows is like, okay, USDC, though it's much lower volume, it appears to be being, you know, used more by like retail people, either for just, they just want dollar exposure in their portfolio, or maybe they're exchanging with USDC or whatever they're doing. Whereas with USDT, like these transaction sizes are not something that like retail people would be making, right? Like, you know, the average income here in Brazil is maybe, you know, if you're like kind of a middle upper class person, you're making between, you know, sort of like $4,000 to $5,000 US dollars a month. So these people are not going around making like $20,000 like USDT transactions, you know, like it's probably not every month. It's probably not going to happen. Right. So it's obviously more of like there's SMEs here that are doing these transactions, or it's just really, really large whale traders too, I suppose is probably a fair amount. So what it appears is that a lot of people are using, a lot of SMEs, like smaller businesses, are using these for basically cross-border payments, right? They're using USDT for to send money, you know, out of the country, or to even just pay for goods or to things like that. It is a little bit unclear of the legality of some of this. Maybe we'll put it that way. There was just a report that came out, you know, last week that was talking about how some federal police have been investigating USDT usage in the country, who is using these thing, who is using this and what are they using it for? It appears that there's some people using it for kind of tax evasion on basically kind of using, I think what's happening is that some people are using, you know, some of these importers. So you import like a case of, you know, or a box of like iPhone cases or something. Right. And you would basically, on the invoice, you would basically mark down the price of the goods by like half because you don't want to pay the import taxes here because they're quite high. And then you would settle like the remainder in crypto, in USDT. And then, but like, as far as, you know, the official tax you're paying on it would be, the official price that you're paying for it would be like half of what the actual cost of the goods is, at least as far as what you're reporting to the government, basically. I think that's what some people are doing with it. I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen any like confirmation of this, but that's what this article was suggesting. This article that was reporting on the police investigation. So it looks like there's some, you know, which maybe isn't a huge surprise that people are using it for that, but like that's appears to be one of the use cases that the police are looking at anyway. But that's just one. I mean, that's just one sort of use case. Obviously, I think there's probably plenty of other people who are using it for, you know, more legit reasons, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, I've heard that before. I lived in Colombia for a while, and there were people who were importing Bitcoin miners, so essentially microchips, and they were doing that not for illegal reasons. They were doing it because it was more efficient and more reliable to use essentially stablecoin payments.
It's just a lot easier, right? So that's the thing. Yeah. I think there might be,
it's cheaper and it's faster and it's more reliable.
It's so much easier. It's so much easier, right? So I think that's one of the reasons that you've seen such a massive uptake of this activity. And I think, you know, I think the authorities see this and they're like, oh, there must be some kind of like nefarious thing going on because they aren't using like the official channels. But it's like, well, the official channels are maybe not that. Like, why would you want to use the official channel when you could just use USDT, right?
But that's kind of an element there, isn't it? Like, we live in a globalized economy, right? And we've talked at length about PIX and the Brazilian government system for payments internally. But the world is not run by nation states. We're not at the Treaty of Westphalia. And so if you want to transact with people in other parts of the world, and it turns out this is a more efficient way to do it, then that's what people will use.
And that's a great point.
An issue there.
Well, and it's like, I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and like, look, we're, you know, how many years are we into this crypto adoption experiment now? 10, 15 years. And like the biggest sort of real world use case that we have right now is USDT on Tron, right?
Right.
Like, that's like people, tons of people around the world use this stuff. Like, you can go like buy like a coffee shop in like Istanbul and pay for your coffee with USDT.
You sure
on
can.
Tron. And people like, people hate on Justin Sun. Like, he's this, you know, like scammer. Like, dude, like, people, say what you want about him, but like, people are using his thing more than anything else, right? So,
yeah. You know, you just have to watch what people are doing and then ask why are they doing it. And if that's a more efficient way in which to do it than running it through MasterCard or Visa or Swift or some other system, people are doing it. Like, that's just the way it goes. You don't really have to wind the clock that far back to think about using Florentine gold ducats to trade. They're scattered all across South Asia. Like, why are Florentine ducats scattered all over South Asia? It's because it's a useful way in which to conduct commerce.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's I like to think of it as kind of the, you know, if you're like you're pouring like kind of water, like down a, you know, down like a hill or something. You try to, you know, if you have kids, like maybe you try doing this where you're in a sandbox and you like pour water down, you try to build a little like blockade with the sand, but the water just always finds a way around. Right. So it's like, you're going to, you construct these little barriers and people will just always find a way around it somehow. Right.
Path of least resistance.
Yeah. They'll always find the path of least resistance. Right. So if you are an importer in some capacity, like it's just, it's like, it, you know, it's so much easier to just send the money out using USDT than using, yeah, using like the quote unquote proper channels. And like, you're going to do that. Right. Especially if there's no law saying that, like, you can't do this, which, you know, so anyway, so that's something I'm really curious to like keep watching here in, especially now that we haven't had numbers coming out over the last, it's been, you know, almost half a year now since we've gotten like official numbers from the government. Before, they were reporting every month. So you kind of watch it in real time, like the adoption of this, but it's been about 6 months since we've had any official numbers come out. So I'm interested to see, well, A, I hope they get their system back up and working here soon, but I'm interested when they do, I'm interested to see like what the volumes have been, especially in relation to USDC, because Circle is actually making a pretty big push in Latin America right now. They've been talking about a lot of, you know, use cases and things. It's kind of a priority region for them. So let's see if they can eat into the USDT market share somehow. So I'm really curious to see if any of that, if they have any success with that, I guess.
Yeah, so am I. I mean, Mercado Libre, they've already integrated the technology. It's already done. And once you switch on 50 million people, that's just this is what's going to happen. So it's constantly evolving. It is interesting. Like, I used to talk about this back when I started my career. It was about like this idea of leapfrogging. You essentially skip a few stages of technology iteration and you leapfrog across, and that seems to be what's happening in Latin America. Why bother with Western Union and the telegraph system, which is where it started, when you can just have everyone with a cell phone and there's an app with something plugged into a global distributed database that just does things that you want it to do?
Well, I think the other thing too is in Latin America and probably other similar parts of the world, like people are just very early adopters of consumer technologies like this. You know, if it works, like people are going to use it. Right. So I remember, you know, the first time I came to Brazil in like 2010, like I'd never even heard of WhatsApp. And the guy that was, you know, the guy that was driving us around was like my, you know, like an uncle's cousin or something. I mean, this dude had like three cell phones. I didn't even have a smartphone at that time. And this dude had like three, and he had like, you know, he had like what his WhatsApp open on his one phone. He had his other phone mounted on his hood. He had, which he had, you know, was telling him where all like the, you know, the speed cameras were. Like, yeah, he had like, you know, he had like the whole like set up on his like, man, like this guy's serious. Like these people like really know how to adopt technology like quickly. If it provides benefits to them, like they'll find a way to use it, you know?
Yeah. And they've all got a supercomputer in their pocket, is the way someone would have said it in 1970. I like Senor Clark. Hey, look, we're coming up on time. Aaron, so we finish up episodes thinking about the future. What have you got your eye on that you think listeners would be interested in, let's say, the next 12 to 24 months? What's interesting to you?
Well, so the two main things that I'm really watching closely are the Drex project here, which we just talked about. You have... Yes. The first phase of the pilot is scheduled to, they're hoping to end this around like May of this year. That's when the first stage of the pilot will wrap up. And then the plan is to try to go live with this thing by like end of next year. And live, when we say live, we don't mean like the entire financial system will be like moved over to this tokenized utopia, but it'll be like the system will be operative basically. And banks will begin sort of experimenting more with it and whatnot. So that will be, very, very important to watch, because I think that like this will be a model. If this works, I think this will be a model that like other countries, other central banks will copy, and will replicate, just as they're trying to replicate PIX. So that is definitely something to watch. And then also I think with, in regard, the central bank is also on another kind of parallel front here. The central bank is coming out with a license, like a VASP licensing regime, in probably about middle of this year, probably like August or so, they'll release this. So there's a bit of a, there's, you're seeing a bit of a, you know, a bit of a knife fight amongst kind of like the local exchanges and the big global exchanges now trying to get into this market, especially now that we're headed back into a bull market. So get it. So Brazil is really going to be a battleground among these exchanges, because you have like the big banks offering crypto. You have like Nubank, Itaú offering crypto. You've got these local guys like Mercado Bitcoin that have been here for a while that everybody kind of knows. You've got like Coinbase ramping up operations here. You've got OKX ramping up operations here. So there's going to be like a lot of competition in the market right now for offering crypto products, investments to consumers, which I think will be good for consumers here. Because heretofore, like there's just been a lot of problems with like pyramid schemes and just crazy stuff where, you know, guys will just, you know, promise, you know, 10% returns per month, take people's money, and half the time they don't even invest it in crypto. They just send it to their Swiss bank account or whatever and like, you know, just steal the money. And there's been a lot of crackdowns on that stuff. There's new penalties on people who are running these pyramid schemes. So hopefully that kind of cleans things up a little bit. But this is, I mean, this could be a really massive market for, I mean, it's not going to, by virtue of like, it's a middle income country. So it's not going to be as lucrative of a market as like a North American or, you know, a Middle East or an Asian market, maybe with higher incomes, but just by the virtue of the size of the country and just the fact that there's such early adoption here of new technologies, I think this is a market that a lot of like, there's just going to be a lot of competition here. Once the VASP regime gets rolled out and people start applying for licenses and things like that. So that's going to be really interesting to watch. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how that economy evolves in conjunction with, maybe we'll call it like the DREX, you know, the DREX tokenization of the financial system vision over the coming years, because there will obviously be some intersections over time. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. But those are kind of the two like main themes, I would say, that are most important right now over the next kind of 12, 24 months, especially if we do end up hitting like a major crypto bull market here, which, you know, all the, you know, the quote unquote experts say that we are going to, but, you know, I guess I'm not sure if I trust these people anymore, but, you know, people say that that's what's going to happen. We are entering a bull market. So sure. Hopefully they're right. But yeah, those are kind of what I'm watching right now.
A bull market is defined as a 20% increase within 12 months.
Well, I mean,
it's happened.
That's nothing for crypto. That's nothing for
no,
crypto.
No, right? Like, it's something so volatile.
Like, I want 200% increase.
It's like, the same way a recession is defined as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. And you go ask, how do you measure GDP, right? So, yes. We're about to watch people rise from the crypt again, and they're gonna go and do the stuff you just mentioned. It's gonna happen. I don't like it, and the extent to which it can be stamped out is a good thing. And then people get the benefits from new technology, and the risks are mitigated. But Brazil is, and I really appreciate you spending the time today to tell us about this. Brazil is one of the most interesting anomalies out there. It's a massive economy with a massive population that has managed to pull off this technological feat on a scale that like Estonia couldn't do at the time. And I'm going to be tracking the trends the same way you do. It's just fascinating to me. But thank you, Aaron. Your time today and the information you provided is much, much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. For US listeners, check out wisdomtreecrime.com on the Apple or Android app stores. Hit subscribe and share. Share. And you can always find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. Thank you for joining us once again. I look forward to seeing you next time. And have an excellent day.